Håkan, please. Catherine, would you please join me for a little discussion? As you like.
I'll sit here.
Yes, please. Yes, thank you. Thank you to the three of you for your inputs. We will have a short exchange between you, and then we open to the public. I would like to connect to what you said about what knowledge really is, and also what you said yesterday in the workshop of democratization of knowledge, the meaning of community knowledge, and connected to what you said about Colin Ward and learning through the city, and the child in the city, and pass the question over to Håkon, who gave very interesting input yesterday on urban pedagogy in the Weimar Republic in Germany. And my question would be, what could we learn from this in connection to what we heard from Kathy and Luis?
So I have to start.
Please.
I thought I would be the last one. Concerning the question about the reform movement, which I talked a little bit about yesterday, and we had a workshop also connecting to that way of thinking, dealt with a group of educational reformers in German-speaking towns in the first two decades of the 20th century, and they all tried to integrate the urban environment and urban landscape. I'm just telling you this because I think that there perhaps are people here who did not participate in the workshop. They tried to integrate the urban landscape into the curriculum and making pupils, especially pupils attending schools, as I showed you now in this presentation, primary schools, working class kids, to out of knowledge about their immediate environment, reach certain social skills. And they were, these reformers, I would not say that they were technically revolutionary, but they tried to make the best out of the utilities that they had at hand, which was a rather strict curriculum before the Weimar Republic, very top-down, and it was a curriculum that also focused very much on literacy, but on a kind of a literacy that was not meant to enhance individuality, but rather like a copy and paste literacy with very hierarchical structures of what you're supposed to read and how you're supposed to write. And for these reformers, it was crucial that the pupils got the ability to self-express themselves and use the reading and writing abilities from school to be able to direct and find orientation in a new society. And what is to be learned from them, I think is something that also could connect to what Catherine said about the border line, or about the borderlands. Because what they actually did, and where they were very successful, and then also a great source of inspiration for many reformers later in the 20th century, was that they worked exactly on the fringes between society and school. They sort of picked up the changes in society and tried to implement them in the school. But also without throwing out the child with the bathwater, what you say, that they still believed that the deep roots of school education had values that you should nourish. You just use them in another way. More adapted for modern society. Yeah.
What I would say to that is, I've been thinking, I found this morning really interesting, thinking about the connections between the three of us, and I'm still thinking about what I think, you know what I mean? And things keep occurring to me, and I think language is really important, and if, you know, inventing new ideas is important, like borderlands, maybe it came to me, it's quite important. I think language is dangerous sometimes as well. So when we talk about the ideal school, to be very careful, because ideal means it's something there to be arrived at, and it connects with what we've been saying about utopia. And what I tried to suggest through Colin Ward's idea of the exploding school and children's idea of school being dynamic, full of life and energy, full of life, life needing to be cared for. So I think we need to think about language and those borderlands. And it occurred to me just now, thinking about Paulo Freire, that I started my career as an adult education worker, and we worked with Freirean principles. So we worked with groups of workers who worked for the local state, who had been rejected by the schooling system, had failed at school. And we worked with dustbin collectors, school cleaners, dinner ladies, gardeners, who had been rejected by education and who rejected education. And we worked with them to develop a curriculum as they came for one day a week away from work. And the curriculum was around what they wanted to know. And the resources were the city, the local city, or the other cities where we took them to find the answers, find experts to tell us. So we worked in a very similar way to how Colin Ward envisaged working. And I think it was a cultural thing at the time. We were hopeful, we were interested in new kinds of pedagogies, new kinds of empowerment. And Colin Ward's work is situated in the 1970s and 80s, in that time. And at that time, because of the post-war consensus, there was a public sector. There were public facilities. Now we have libraries being closed down. We have everything becoming privatized, which makes the kind of pedagogy we've been talking about more difficult to achieve. And it's that border between the school and the community and what we might call our collective public investment in society that really matters. All those borders really matter. So that's what's in my mind at the moment.
Yeah. Yesterday I talked a little bit about the idea of the knowledge, right? And I think I talked about today, and I was thinking of the connections of with knowledge, power, and space. I was thinking a lot about your examples. For example, of the schools for the working class being the architects being considered of the beauty that had to be there. That was, it struck to me, because I think that connects very well with the case of Porto Alegre. It's not that they thought of beauty, but they thought of building buildings that are not makeshift, or buildings that are not going to fall apart in 2 months or something like that, which is the case of many schools in Brazil. So the idea of building a building that is solid, that is the best building in the neighborhood, which can provide spaces, like you were saying, spaces for these communities. Remember, you have to imagine it's communities have no presence of the state there, so it's like this no man's land, and all of a sudden there's this building where the community can use, where they can use it at night for their meetings, or where there's a library, where in all of a sudden there's this new space that is present and that is respected, and I think that connects with knowledge as well, because Because the message that we send to poor families, usually by having horrible schools for them, is that we don't care about you, really. This is the kind of buildings that you get. You're not going to get anything better than this. And by being conscious of the need to, there's a very important sort of image going on, a pedagogical image going on by building schools that are solid in those particular communities, because that symbolizes the compromise, the statement that the state is there and this is a place of the community. I think this is really important, and it connects also to your talk as well. So I think those are crucial ideas.
Thank you. I have a question to Kathy. You said that the whole curriculum could be taught through the arts. How could that look like?
Okay, the whole curriculum was taught through the arts at a school called Stewart Street School in Birmingham in the 1940s, during the war years, and I've written about this with Ian Grosvenor. So if you go to my webpage, if you're interested, we've written a couple of articles about that school. It's a really interesting example. An elementary school, a really gruesome-looking building, you know, very high, dark, designed for didactic education. But the war had some positive effects in education in that it allowed teachers to experiment. And already the ideas of education through art had strongly been there from the 1930s, actually, before Herbert Read wrote his book. Arthur Stone was the headmaster of this particular school, and he took it upon himself to experiment, and he created a curriculum that was taught entirely through the arts, through the dramatic and performing and visual arts. And this was an extraordinary school that attracted a lot of attention, no least from the Ministry of Education. In 1949, the minister, the senior inspector of schools, Christian Schiller, asked Arthur Stone, the head teacher, to write about what he was doing in this school. And he wrote a pamphlet called Story of a School, which was also illustrated with beautiful images of children working in the school. And this was a school in the poorest part of Birmingham. It was it was definitely a public school. And this pamphlet was sent out free to all new primary schools. I say new because 1944, the legislation created primary education in England and Wales. So every school in the country was sent this pamphlet, Story of a School, which just set out how the curriculum, the primary curriculum, could be taught through the arts. I mentioned Sir Alec Clegg from Yorkshire. He visited this school and he talked about it as an epiphany. It formed the kind of baseline, convincing him about what really mattered in education. And he recruited the head teacher, Arthur Stone, and took him to Yorkshire, and he became an advisor for art and movement education. It's a really wonderful story. So that is an example. But of course, we haven't mentioned the backlash, the reaction to all this progressive adventure. That's another story.
Okay, thank you. I have a last question to the three of you before I open to the public. Maybe a very vague question. But Kathy, you said in the beginning that democracy is something that has to be worked on. And you were speaking about learning to live together. And yesterday in our workshop, Democratization of Knowledge, we heard that democracy also has to be learned. how can we learn democracy?
How many days do we have? I didn't hear what you said. Okay. Well, I think, yeah, so yesterday we were talking about the fact that sometimes we assume, so I was talking particularly about participation, which is a crucial element of democracy, right? Which, for some reason, has not been discussed very well, I think. We talk about democracy as a very sort of abstract concept, but participation is crucial. If there's no participation, there's no democracy, you know? So I think when I said that participation has to be learned is that sometimes we assume, and this is the case, it was a very important aspect of what was tried in the city of Porto Alegre. You open spaces for participation, and all of a sudden you have people who were never invited to participate, never thought that they had anything to say or to collaborate. They never even thought of themselves as worthy of participating in these very poor communities. And you have this, you know, yesterday we were talking about in our workshop about this moment of panic where everybody looks at each other and say, what should we do now? And the thing is, participation and democracy is a learning process. We have to learn how to do that. I was talking yesterday about a sort of a grammar of participation that has to be invented, and it cannot be universal in that sense, because it is very related to context, to where, how are the relationships there, and we have to face issues of power when we talk about participation, because we have to understand who has the voice to talk in this particular space. And so that's what I meant by learning. There's a process of learning how to do that, how to negotiate, how to live together, so in the case of Porto Alegre, what I say, it's very interesting because what have to happen in order for real participation to happen is that not only communities had to learn, and that's the position that we are put, right? The state and then the school system knows what to teach to the communities. There had to be a reverse process of learning. So the state and the state people who were embody the state in those particular moments had to learn how to interact with those particulars. So the state had to be taught how democracy is done. And that is not a simple thing to do. But I think in that particular context, history matters. By doing that, by practicing that, by doing that constantly and learning through the obstacles, that's how democracy is built. There's no other way.
Thank you. And Hakon, would you see a potential of learning democracy in urban pedagogy if you think of appropriating the space, appropriating the city, like learning the right to the city, or like becoming a citizenship, or like understanding the citizenship by urban pedagogy? Hopefully you can.
Yeah, it's difficult to be very, very precise. What I've been thinking about now when you ask questions and when I hear Eloise answers and Kathy's answers is partly that I think that something that we have in common in our research and also the practical experiences that Luis has from the Porto Alegre School is that democracy is a learning process. Yes, that sort of tends to reoccur in our research and our opinions, and that is something that we have sort of identified. But then in the contemporary world, that learning process is not always embraced. I mean, that is because you are positioning yourself or the society in an unstable situation. So democracy is something that is something that could always sort of tip over into something else that is less desirable, I would say, in an educational perspective or a societal perspective. But that is how society functions. So I guess in a realistic but still positive situation, there will always be some kind of dynamic conflict between education and power.
Thank you. Would you like to say something, Kathy, to that question?
I'm looking forward to the questions from the audience. Okay. But I would say what's in my mind at the moment are those people who are passionate about democratic schools. There are things called democratic schools out there, and they are interesting. But again, I would be careful with the label. Once you've got a label there, you know, democratic school, it's democratic. Democratic education, you must be doing something, in the curriculum. Citizenship education. Remember what Alec Clegg said, the things that are most valuable are the things that are difficult to measure. So I would go with him with that. And there's plenty of examples of what we might call democratic practice in schooling, which is not labelled democratic school. And those, Kerry Facer talks about the seeds for the future school being in the present, and those are the seeds I'm interested in growing. And growth was a word that was used in the post-war period. So I would say, rather than ideal or democratic schools, growing schools, each generation being given the responsibility to grow a school, a community, if we are to have schools at all.
We have a first question.
My name is Heiner Benking. I'm in a United Nations Democracy Fund project and with the Council of Global Issues. I would like to thank the organizers. I mean, it needs a scheme to really have such three people on one panel, because this bridging of history, arts, education, democracy is so difficult. So I will wonder how we can get you three closer together, because the fringes of society and school... I see, we are on the way.
I tell you... We just all became Facebook friends this morning.
That's a good start. We were talking about the fringes, and it's not about between society and school, but with the urban and the pagan, and that has a density problem. Berlin, very good example. 70 years ago, Isadora Duncan really starting dance with children. But what happened? This density is for organizers, for planners, deadly. So Hobrecht started the infrastructure, and so all schools didn't have place anymore. So I think it is very important that we discuss what is me, what is you, what is wild, what is pagan, urban and rural affairs, we call it. Second, the issue of libraries and terminologies and labeling is so important. I urge you to continue further with that. And actually, I'm very happy to be here, because I will report about this conference in 5 weeks in Finland, in Turku, where we 24 years ago have been doing such a children communication camp. And my task is to look back and forward. So I learned a lot here all the days, and I hope to continue, not only on Facebook.
There's a question. Yeah. Thank you very much. It was, again, very inspiring. And I have a question to Louise, because I'm very happy that you talked about the word participation. But just as Catherine Burke said, I'm afraid that participation might become a label. And my question is, to what extent or how could we get a more critical mode of speaking about participation? Because when it comes to participation and educational architecture, I hear examples where a first generation of students are allowed to plan their school. And then, of course, yeah, we do have a certain amount of participation, but then it ends once the school is built. And, of course, there might be devices in architecture which might need some change. But, yeah, I'm afraid that this participation is kind of not that critical in a way. And I think that, or would you agree that there are certain predispositions in a habitus or a child which allows somebody to participate or not? I mean, there might be children who simply don't or feel that they wouldn't have the language to participate, or yeah, simply don't know how to do it or are not used to it. And that might be even more excluding. So how can we think of a more critical way and not labeling participation as something which is conflict-free and very easy to do? Yeah.
Please, please. So I'll start with your question, because I think it's a great one. And I think it also connects with the question of language, right? So participation is a new key word that is used in the business world, right? Participation is like a real important one now. Everybody needs to participate. But participation is seen as something like you see yourself as an entrepreneur, right? So that's, you see yourself as an entrepreneur, and then as an individual, you participate because you're creating spaces for yourself, and you know, it's a, that idea is, I think, relates to what I was talking in the beginning of this rearticulation of language and how language is being sort of taken in, and the content is sort of shifted and changed, and so I completely agree with you. And the example that I gave yesterday at the workshop, I said that participation can be like this. Okay, so I want to buy a car, and I want you to participate in giving me the money to buy the car. You're participating, aren't you? Aren't you happy? Right? So that is participation, but that has no, you know, really, I mean, probably most of you would rather not participate in that particular case. And participation also can be a way of legitimizing ideas that are dominant as well, right? And rather than looking at the edges and looking at ideas that are not in the front. So it's the idea of, okay, let's vote for who has the majority. That's a democratic way, but that sort of eliminates the other ideas that were probably as important as this one, or probably more disruptive sometimes, that are thrown away because of that. So in the Porto Alegre case, what they tried to do was to create a dynamic where participation would mean that different voices would be heard. And of course, I would agree with you that in that particular case, the majority of the kids didn't even feel that they had something to communicate, because the idea is that they were coming to school to be filled, to be filled with the knowledge that the school had. And so what do I have to say? I have nothing to say. I want to be taught, right? And that is a legitimate, I wouldn't just say, oh, that's a very conservative thing. Just, you know, try to understand that your knowledge is important. No, that's a valuable idea that, you know, I'm here to be taught. But then to be taught what, right? What kinds of expertise? So the idea that we go back to Freire, I think, and his ideas of, okay, we start with the knowledge that you have and then you build from there, right? And you connect that knowledge with others, and that is when participation really can be more powerful, and not just a, you know, an idea of an individual being able to communicate better their ideas. Yeah, I think it's a very crucial idea, and I think it connects to the idea of this labeling and connecting and this disruption of the labeling, which I think is very important.
Hi, Kerry Facer. Thank you for those fantastic talks. What's clear to me is that it's not just schools and teachers and children that make a difference, but also brilliant bureaucrats. So good planners. All of your stories tell us that. So I suppose my question is can you think today of equivalently brilliant bureaucrats? So can you name any? Where are they? What are they doing? And what one book or object, you're historians, some of you, so objects might be right, would you give to today's bureaucrats to help them to think intelligently about education?
That's a nice question. I will take notes, please.
My. We were joking here. The answer is no, we don't know any bureaucrats. It's a tough time for that, right? I think even in the case of Porto Alegre, for example, the bureaucrats, if you want to call them that, the administrators, the people in charge of making policy and making the systems work, they have a lack of imagination. They're just a graduate student of mine wrote about the idea of a vacuum of policy, actually, the absence of policy, because that in a way creates the maintenance of the status quo. You don't even need to have a right-wing government. you have this vacuum of policy where some schools still resist and create dynamics, but then the rest sort of goes back to the old practices because they're not being pushed. They're not being pushed to be different, to think differently, and these kinds of things. So I think one of the things that I was thinking about was that we probably need more documentation of these experiences that were described here. They need to be more connected. So I understand why you were saying that the work has to be connected, because I think that's very powerful. When it's almost like sometimes you're trying to convince people that this is a new thing, but it is not, as we heard many consistently, you know. Like even when there's this building of schools for the very poor, you know, at least there's this spark of imagination still there, you know, that these are human beings that deserve an aesthetic experience as well, right? And so this is not new. We have to reconnect with those things, I think.
Hi, Kerry. I've just located you up there. Yes. Yeah, great question. Yeah. Difficult one. I can only talk about my home land. And the bureaucrat that is still alive, I tend to deal with dead people. I try and catch them while they're still around. But the bureaucrat that is still alive is Tim Brighouse. Tim Brighouse, he's worth something. And the book I would give him, and actually I did give him, there's a story here, is a book called Children in Distress. And it was published in 1968. And it was written jointly by Sir Alec Clegg.
Surprise, surprise.
And Barbara Megson, who nobody knows anything about, but watch this space. So Tim Brighouse was a director of education, like Alec Clegg. He was director of education in Birmingham more recently. And Tim Brighouse has written about Alec Clegg, and he's written about that school, Stewart Street School. He knows the whole story. But I had to remind him about this little book, Children in Distress, which you can probably buy on Amazon for a penny. I did, and pay for the postage. It's a wonderful little book. And it reminds us that, well, what Alec Clegg was talking about there was the importance of language again. And he recognized back in the 1960s that children were being labeled as subnormal, whatever the language was at that time, educationally needy, maladjusted. And he wanted to bring a new word into the vocabulary of education, distress. And he defined that as children who were struggling with life, who were unable to be happy, partly through poverty, dysfunctional families, humiliation, abuse. So they were coming to school already hungry, suffering, and so on. And he wanted to get us to recognize this huge number of children who were in distress. So on July the 15th this year in Cambridge, there's going to be an event which is about... It's trying to capture the public attention at the moment to mental health issues among young children, which seem to be enormous. And they haven't really been mentioned in this last few days that I've picked up on, but at home it's a very big issue, rightly so. And we're having an event in Cambridge, and Tim Brighouse is coming along to tell us that he's reread the book and what he thinks about it. And we've actually found Barbara Megson, who co-wrote the book. And she's alive and, well, a little bit crumpled, but living in Cambridge. I wonder what the translators said then. So see me if you want to partake in this event in Cambridge. Go punting and come to an event about children in distress, past and present.
I will try to have a go, although I will probably answer rather vaguely. Thank you for the questions. And also thank you for your talk at the beginning of the conference. I thought that was really very interesting and inspiring. I would say like this, no, I don't know any bureaucrats. I would, from my examples I gave now, I would give as a gift to inspire somebody, I would give the entrance of one of the schools I showed. Actually, it's one of the two schools that are placed on opposite sides of the railway tracks in Prenzlauer Berg, the one built 1900 by Ludwig Hoffmann. At the short end of that building, which is the only short end facing the actual street, I would give the entrance to somebody because it doesn't say school over the entrance, it says reading room, which means that you want to enter there because it could be a library there and some quietness. And it's like indicates that this is much more than a school. It's a place where you're supposed to develop or be curious, which is a great entrance for a school. I think that... this is also something very problematic when talking still about bureaucrats. You can, in my sources, you can see some kind of civic pride, town pride among the bureaucrats. They want their cities to be representative and function in a way that is kind of old-fashioned and definitely belong to a pre-democratic era. So that has nothing to do with democracy. And this kind of pride has also dissolved gradually due to political changes. I can just take my own country as an example, where you now daily talk about the free school market and about new public management that have sort of made a complete different map over what it actually means to have an educational system. And in that system, that kind of old-fashioned pride of belonging to an urban community that functions and sort of let part of your career ambitions be dissolved into a community, something that is collective, is very difficult to find. So you had to create that kind of togetherness in other ways. And I think that we are still very much like struggling in finding that common platform. So, yeah, thank you for the question again.
If there's not another very urgent question, I would like, is there a question? Okay, there's one question. I take the last question before I close. Up there.
Thank you. Actually, I do think it is kind of urgent. I wanted to ask about how we deal with the challenges of teaching in multiracial and multi-faith societies, specifically with reference to sort of not perpetuating a colonial dynamic within a classroom and an institution. It's urgent.
I can talk a little bit about the case of Porto Alegre, and because I think it talks a little bit about that. It's not about, you know, immigration or immigrants, but it's about the whole race dynamics of the country and I think of Brazil. And Porto Alegre is the capital of the whitest state in the country, which doesn't mean that they are not Afro-Brazilians, though, quite the opposite. If you go to the schools, the majority of the kids are actually black. And so one of the first things that the schools had to address was, for example, if you look at the history of textbooks in Brazil, they don't deal with issues of race because the assumption is that Brazil is a racial democracy, right? So you don't need to deal with that. And of course, those are the first things that they had to deal with. They had to reimagine curriculum around not usually what you do, that you put multiculturalism as a little, you know, sprinkle in the borders, but they had to reshape the whole curriculum to rethink the whole history of Brazil and to teach these kids about their own history, which was never taught in any of their experiences. And so that was a crucial part of the project there. And that, so in a way, it guided, for example, that yesterday I spoke about the way curriculum is structured in those schools, and it's about what they call the thematic complex. And that comes from, you know, weeks of conversation in the communities or what should be the guiding ideas. And many of those schools chose issues of race as important. So every single subject, school subject, had to address those issues. So in math, you would learn about, you know, how the statistics of Brazil show that there are, you know, the majority of the population is white, but actually, if you look a little deeper, Brazil is actually a black country. And so it's very interesting the way that everybody had to sort of use their expertise to address those kinds of issues. And I think I would agree with you, that is a crucial and urgent matter.
I would just say quickly, it is an urgent matter, and it is a short-term and long-term matter, and there are different answers to the short-term and the long-term. What I would say is I'm convinced that it needs to shift from being an adult, teacher-adult concern to a children and young people's concern. What I mean is, if children and young people are given the space and time to take this matter seriously, and really that might mean a lot of space and a lot of time in the school curriculum, and give them adequate time, I'm convinced that it is, they can show adults, they can show the way on that particular issue. I base that on the evidence of 30,000 pieces of work that were sent in to the school I'd like in the UK. There's a chapter in the book about inclusivity, which reflects really the very powerful ideas about social justice and ideas of inclusivity that children expressed. And I'm convinced that there will be consistency when children in Germany are asked the same sorts of questions. When they're asked to describe an education for the future, they will talk about those things. So I think we have to pass, we have to let it go, maybe, and give the space and time to children and young people to help us, to guide us as adults.
No, I don't consider my, it's an urgent question, but I don't consider myself an expert, and I think there are probably many people that know more about this issue in the audience, and I think that my colleagues here have given very good answers, so I just pass.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Louise, thank you, Kathy and Hakon, for your talks and the discussion, and thank you for listening. We will have a break of 1 hour now, so you can go and get some food and some drinks and rest or whatever you need, and we will continue at 3 o'clock with Gerd Biester and the Beautiful Risk of Education.